Well, a fouling foundation can lead to all kinds of problems for you. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. John Freiberger back with us to talk about how to properly maintain and repair those foundations. And, of course, answer your other home repair questions as well. John is with Freiberger Construction Consulting, a registered home inspector, 4 decades of experience in restoring older homes. So it's great to have him back. And certainly look forward to your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mueller Show. And John, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Great to be back again, Larry.
We have, before we talk about foundations, I wanted us to address a question a listener had for you. I think it was about 4 months back. It had to do with wave ventilation, and I know you did some research on that.
I did. It's always nice when they stump the chump and I have to go out and learn something, Larry. And so the first thing I did is I, of course, went to the internet, and I found the advertising for Wave Home Solutions. And basically what this is this is an exhaust fan that you put in your basement.
Okay.
And it has a, sort of a little duct system, so it draws the worst air off the floor, which is usually the coolest and dampest, and expels it outside. And their advertising, their advertising is somewhat deceptive here and there. It looks like the EPA and the World Health Organization endorse them. They don't. So after looking at this, I went, well, what are the problems here? We're going to exhaust air from the basement. Where does the makeup air come from? Wave thinks it comes from the upper stories of the house. So that basically, if you get the damp air out of the basement, the cooler air from and drier air from upstairs falls into the basement. Except we know that's not true, because we've done blower door tests in Wisconsin on tens of thousands of homes. A lot of the leakage comes through the ring joists. We're just bringing outside air into the basement. The other thing that I found, I'm a member of the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, Air Conditioning Engineers, a really exciting organization. But it does have a great archive of research. So I went to some work by Joel Stilbrick, who's a PhD engineer and does a lot of writing and is the president of building science. He's one of the really early building science people in the United States back in the 70s. And I read his article on ventilation, and his article is entitled something like, "Exhaust ventilation only, don't do it."
Oh.
We also had the last program we were here, a gentleman called in about whole house fans, and I told him I had a pretty negative opinion on him. One of the quotes in Joe's article was, if we want to mine radon, we'd use whole house fans. So one of the things that we have to think about is if we're exhausting only from our house, the air's got to come from someplace. If we depressurize the basement, we can increase the soil moisture that comes into the basement and the radon that comes into the basement. We can also draw in moist air from outside. Now, outside at 85 degrees, it may be 55% drops into the basement. Where it's 55 degrees, it may suddenly be 80%. So wave ventilation, I think, is probably a product that is not terribly useful, and it should be avoided. Dehumidification is what we really need if we want to control humidity in our house. Though what we really want, as Joel Stilbrick's various articles say, is we want the HRVs and the ERVs that we talk about so frequently. We want whole ducted systems in houses where we are exhausting air and bringing in exactly the same volume of conditioned air back into the house.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, let's turn to concrete for a bit here. I think, was it the Romans invented concrete?
Well, I don't know if the Romans invented it, but they certainly used it a lot. One of the greatest buildings of the world, the Pantheon, is basically a non-reinforced concrete building, although because it's a dome, it's got these wonderful cast iron, wrought iron tension rings running around holding it up. But the Romans used lime putty, so they burned limestone, and then they found this, pozzolana. It's a fine volcanic ash, and they found that if they mix this lime together with this ash, when they added water, they ended up with a chemical reaction that gave them a waterproof cement. So many of the Roman aqueducts, we see all this stone. Well, a lot of that stone's on the exterior, and these are actually concrete structures, and they're waterproof concrete structures. In the U.S., one of the first really large uses of concrete that we know of was for the Erie Canal. And near Syracuse, New York, they found a particular limestone that had silica and iron and magnesium and all kinds of stuff in it. And they found that when they burned it and made it into a concrete powder and then mixed it with water, it would actually harden underwater. So this was used without reinforcement for the canal. And then all over the eastern United States, we had foundations that were called tabby. So people knew that you could burn lime and make lime putty mortar and lay bricks and lay stone in it. Well, they found that if you did the same thing with this lime putty mortar, basically burned limestone, added gravel and water to it and poured it up in forms, you had sort of a wall that to us looks much like a concrete wall. Quite soft, but it was suitable. The real change in concrete comes in the 1880s and the 1890s when the rotary kiln is brought to the United States in the 1880s, and chemists really begin to understand what the alkali putty means, how to make the concrete stronger. We were able to come up with quality control. So concrete got better and better in the U.S., and a lot of the work, the initial work was done by the U.S. government. If you go to some of the western forts, most of which are abandoned now, but the old cavalry forts out west, you see poured concrete buildings because the quartermaster wanted stuff that they could maintain very easily, that couldn't be burned down, and they found that poured concrete walls would be great. And then the modern era really begins with the invention, or not the, well, the patenting. I shouldn't say the invention. We don't know when it was invented. But in 1884, a gentleman whose name I forgot patented reinforced concrete. And, of course, when we go to our big buildings like the building we're in or Humanities Building across the street or the immensely ugly Boston City Hall or the parking ramps we all use, we are looking at reinforced concrete buildings. And if we've been in those parking ramps, Larry, we know what water and salt can do, especially when water and salt gets in contact with that reinforcement bar, causes it to rust, thereby expand, and thereby start blowing the concrete apart. And we do have houses in Wisconsin with a lot of reinforced concrete, usually in a if you have a garage tucked under the house, we'll often find that there's a concrete ceiling in the garage, which is the floor for very often a screen porch, an outdoor porch, or a sunroom above. And when we inspect homes, it's very important to look for cracks that are indicating that the reinforcement in the concrete in these residential structures is beginning to fail due to moisture intrusion.
Oh, and that's something that a home inspector should note.
A home inspector should know the SPS 134, which anybody can download, is the standards for home inspectors in Wisconsin. And a home inspector is to describe the type of foundation you have in your house and its condition. So they should know the difference between concrete block and poured concrete and whether there's seepage coming through it, whether there is rust jacking as the failure of the steel. These are things that a home inspector should note. And I think it's a real good idea. There's a lot of homes being sold right now, Larry. We've been busier than heck, and we've been called in on quite a few lately where the inspections were not what the sellers really wanted. So those of you who are going to hire a home inspector, I really suggest that you download this section 134. Just type in Wisconsin Home Inspector Rules. You'll get the whole thing. It's only 4 or 5 pages. It tells you what an inspector is supposed to do and what an inspector doesn't have to do. And when you talk to your inspector, say, when I use the word describe, what do you do when you describe something? If he's just checking off a blank that says wood foundation, cement foundation, or concrete block foundation, well, he's really not describing it. I mean, he's saying this is what the material is. But they're not describing the condition. We really want to know when we buy a house, what are we buying? And the home inspector's job is to help you really know what you're buying.
So is there an association of home inspectors or someplace where we can go, you know, to...
Well, that's an interesting question. I received a shocking email last week that the National Association of Home Inspectors was dissolving.
Oh!
I've been a member for...
forever.
Forever. Well, evidently, I'm now a member of the American Society of Home Inspectors, which is the other has always been the other major one. Mm-hmm. There's another one that is called Notchy and another one called InterNotchy, and frankly, I don't know too much about them. But the American Society of Home Inspectors, generally, if you're hiring a home inspector, they need to be registered in the state of Wisconsin, which all that means is they've passed a test and they're doing their education. But if you look at the American Society of Home Inspectors, you can go to their website, type in Wisconsin, or type in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Nina, whatever. Mm-hmm. You will get association members who are in your area. You don't have to be a member of the association. It costs money. It's a couple hundred dollars a year. So if you find a home inspector who's willing to put that extra money out for the extra education and the extra code of ethics and standards, then you're hiring somebody who's a little bit above average.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Well, we have Stephen Krivitz with a question for you, John, so let's go there. Steve, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I don't know if you can help me with this, but I have an old farmhouse with a fieldstone basement, and I would like to retouch point areas of it as well as probably add some stone. Do you know what the best mortar mix would be for something like that?
I do, Steve, and I'll tell you real briefly, and then I'm going to suggest that anyone who has questions about old mortars and what mortar to use for old foundations or for old brick or old stone walls, to go ahead and email me at FREI.
FREI.
At chorus, like a group of singers, CHORUS, mm-hmm. .net.
Okay.
And I have a cover letter, a history of mortar, and a complete specification for you. But basically, here's the theory behind it, Steve, is you want to match the mortar you already have. And the mortar you have, and Larry and I were talking earlier about this tabby foundations.
Yeah.
Well, this was it. It was basically burned limestone. And that's what we had in Wisconsin. We have a lot of limestone, so we had a lot of lime kilns. You can see some of them yet in like High Cliff State Park and mm-hmm. and a couple down near Belmont, Wisconsin. So we burned limestone, and we basically made lime putty. If you look at the old limestone, burned lime mortar, you'll see actually white little chunks in it, usually about the size of a pencil eraser. Those are actually unburned chunks of limestone that have turned white. So you want a soft mortar. You don't want to go to the hardware store and buy the gray Portland-based stuff that may be 3,000-pound mortar. You want an 800 to 1,000-pound mortar. So you want something soft if you're working with old stone or old brick, because many old bricks are really quite soft. Hard bricks really didn't come out until the 1940s and the 1950s. And with the hard bricks, we can use a harder mortar. But if you and any other listeners email me, I have these all put together with a cover letter, because I probably send out 100 of these a year. So be happy to help you.
There we go.
Is that the one you were talking about that the Romans used? It was the waterproof?
No. This was something that's similar to what is called hydraulic cement, and you do not want to attempt to use that. That will not bond very well. You know, we have to think about the chemical reactions that go on when we're repairing something. And what we have to do is we have to make sure that what we're repairing will stick.
Right.
So if we put something like a Portland-based against a pure old soft lime mortar, we're just not going to get a good chemical bond.
And that's what I was going to do.
Oh. Well, you saved yourself here, I think, a little bit, Steve.
The nice thing about this mortar mix I'm going to send you, Steve, is I call it a good throwing mortar. It's sticky.
Oh.
You can throw it against the wall and it sticks. So it will work very nicely, and I have instructions in there on how you need to wet things and other little details so that you can actually do this yourself.
And that's FREI at chorus.net.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I think you just made Steve's day here, John. Let's go to Tab and Mazamani next. Tab, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning, Larry and guest. My daughter bought a 1907 house in Wanakee. It has a stone foundation, and it sticks up like, you know, a couple of feet above grade. And then they have a concrete driveway just attached really close to the stone foundation. In some areas, I can stick my finger there, go a couple of inches. In some areas, half an inch to an inch. And my question is, is there any recommendation for me to fill the gap between the concrete driveway and the stone foundation so if this material freezes, it doesn't push the foundation in?
Okay. We have the concrete already there. And the question is that concrete going to expand and push against the foundation? If we've got a half-inch gap, hopefully not. What we would have liked to have seen when that concrete driveway was poured is some foam or something, a crushable material put between the stone foundation, but that ship has sailed.
Right.
So maybe one of the things to think about is if we're not too terribly worried about thermal expansion of concrete, and of course it's actually going to shrink in the winter as it gets colder, is let's worry about frost heaving. Because if we saturate that soil underneath, it can both lift the concrete and push on the stone wall. So what you may want to do is go on the internet and look up caulking with foam rod, F-O-A-M rod. Because what we
Why don't you repeat that one more time?
Yes, foam rod, F-O-A-M. And you can get this at most hardware stores and certainly at concrete supply places.
Yeah.
Now, you're in Mesomany, so you're close
to... No, the house is in Wanakee.
Oh, house is in Wanakee. All right. So you're close to Madison Block and Stone, you're close to Country Concrete on Nesbitt Road, and they will have the products there. Basically, what we want to do when we caulk will stick to two surfaces, not three. So if you fill an open joint with dirt at the bottom with caulk, it might stick to one side in the bottom, which means it isn't doing anything. So the foam rod is a bond breaker. It's something to which caulk will not stick. And we have to get foam rod of different sizes, push it down in there so that we have about as much depth as width to the crack. And then we can use things like a self-leveling urethane, like Sonelastic SL1 would possibly be a good choice. But there's so many new things coming out at caulks, in caulks. What I always suggest you do is take a couple pictures. Go to a place like County Concrete, which is, you know, most places are so consumer-friendly now. Say, look, I want foam rod and a caulk for doing this. What's the best and newest product? Is it self-leveling urethane? Is it butyl? What should I use? Get some expert advice, and then be very careful about how you install it. If you install it correctly, it's going to last 5 to 10 years. If you install it wrong, it's going to last a week.
Okay. All right.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. We have Lucia on Facebook says her house has bare dirt underneath, no basement. Wants to know, as a homeowner, what should she be doing, if anything? So it's a...
bare dirt. Well, I don't have a lot of information here. Now, we do find a lot of older houses that will have a crawl space rather than a basement. Now, maybe that's what she means, is she's got a foundation wall running around the house and the floor underneath is dirt. And we don't know where she lives or how damp the soil is, but one of the big worries we have, and we talked about this with Wave and Whole House Fans, is radon and water vapor coming out of the soil. So unless this is a ventilated space, now it could be a house up on piers, because we still have those in Wisconsin, in which case it's well ventilated. But if it's an enclosed crawl space or shallow basement, if it has a curtain wall around it, then we really want to get in and seal that soil. And the easiest way to do that is to use plastic sheeting, often called visqueen. 6 millimeter is good. 8 millimeter is even better. We want to get that over the soil. And where there are maybe columns or at the sidewalls, we want to try to seal that to the walls with a caulk that will work with the plastic. So try to eliminate moisture and radon coming up out of the soil that may be working its way into the house and maybe causing increased humidity and fungal growth in that area.
Very, very good advice. John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn talks with the author of a book that looks at how the smallpox epidemic of 1721 started the controversial practice of inoculation and motivated the free press, changing politics, medicine, and journalism forever. That's at 1. Right now, talking about home improvement today with John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg. Great to have him along. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, or email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Rick in Madison next. Rick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'll change the conversation to black mold. Recently, we were in the process of putting new tile in our bathroom and kind of had a deadline with the builders starting on Monday, and we were tearing down the old walls, and we ran into black mold, and I was only wearing a dust mask at the time, and then after reading all about black mold, we kind of freaked out and went out and bought hazmat suits and ventilators and wiped the whole area behind the tub and as much as we could reach, you know, with Concrobium and vacuumed with a HEPA vac and closed it all back up. And I had the air tested in weeks following the remodel, and she was able to go behind the tub area and still found evidence of black mold spores. And now this fall, we are having the house sided, and I've talked to the builder and asked if I could have another shot at the backside of that tub and cleaning it, the mold once again, you know, with all the, you know, ventilator and hazmat suit and such. But I'm wondering, do you think I should have that done professionally, or do you think that's a job that we can effectively do ourselves?
I'm trying to remember the EPA rule, but I think it's 3 square feet. And that once you get beyond 3 square feet, I believe the EPA says you really need to hire a professional. So if I've got you, if I'm understanding you correctly, Rick, what we've got is a bathtub, and the outside, the bathtub sidewall was the outside wall of the house.
Correct.
And then you had what, drywall or something back there?
It was cement board.
It was cement board. So the cement board had black mold on it. Now, you had an air test done, and I'm assuming that the spores were sent to a lab. And what type of spores? I mean, there's black mold and there's black mold. Was this a Strediboccia? And how much of it was found in the air test?
Yeah, I don't know specifically
okay.
that. I was told it was black mold.
That's not real helpful information, because I mean we've got 40,000 types of molds in the world, and we don't want to get, well, we've got to be careful with mold, but we don't want to go and spend $10,000 on a remediation if we don't have to. I think that your idea of attacking this from the exterior is good. One of the things you're going to want to find out is how did the water get back there?
It was right, and that I understand was, you know, failing tile and caulk and grout, and that's all been removed.
Okay. We want to make very sure that that was the case. And if you are taking out the weather barrier on the exterior of the house, you'll have an opportunity to see if there were additional leaks. And there may have been additional leaks that were affecting that, because usually, if you have Portland cement board, that is not a great place to try to grow mold. It'll grow on the dust on the board, but it won't grow on the mold board itself, unlike drywall, which is a wonderful, you can grow mushrooms on drywall anytime. So I think open it up from the outside, and if it is less than 3 square feet, what you may be able to do is HEPA vac it and then simply encapsulate it and then put the wall back together. The other thing you could do is foam that section of the wall, so you had a complete air barrier, vapor barrier, and a thermal barrier behind the tub. That is certainly going to keep it very dry. It's going to prevent any air movement from taking any random spores and pushing it into the house. And since you have this opportunity to access it from the exterior, I think you can do that with your whoever your siding contractor is.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good luck.
Much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick, for calling. Appreciate it. We have John on Facebook has a home with a cinder block basement and has concrete with has concerns with high moisture and possible mold on the blocks. Any advice on how to get a repair done, or what do you do for estimates?
And mold on the block. Okay, then that and concrete masonry units, we call them cinder blocks, way, 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 way back when. They actually did put cinders in cinder blocks, but I don't think they have for the last 100 years. But so we really call them concrete blocks or concrete masonry units, CMUs. And basically what they're made of, concrete. They're made of sand and gravel and things that will not grow mold, but the dirt on the surface will. In many cases, what we can do is we can simply wash the walls. And I actually like Dawn just soap. Mm-hmm. Do not use bleach. Don't use chemicals. Don't use things that are going to hurt your lungs. You may be able to pressure wash, but you have to be careful that you don't damage the block and the mortar. But if this is simply discoloration on the walls, I think simply washing the walls is what you want to do. Now, you need to then start looking at the exterior of this house and say to yourself, why am I getting moisture in the basement? Are my gutters in good shape? Are my downspouts run out far enough? Do I have good grading in the yard? Is water washing up against this foundation? We need to have a half-inch drop for the first 10 feet around the house. That's 5 inches of drop in the first 10 feet, Larry, which is a fair amount of pitch.
Yeah.
And with a block home, because block, they're hollow in the middle. So you've got a inch-thick wall of fairly permeable concrete. Once the water gets through that, it can travel quite a ways. So we really need to start on the outside, make sure we can get this wall dry so that once we clean it up safely, it is not going to become dirty looking again.
Laura in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I was going to ask about my driveway, but then I thought that my foundation was more important. So is it okay if I ask about that?
Sure.
Okay. So my foundation, I pretty much have narrowed down a lot of the issues, but I'm not, and Project Home is coming out to work on it. But the water softener is leaking. That's one problem. Another problem is there's a vent in the where the furnace is. There's a vent outside to outside, and the water is coming in there. They're going to address that too. The ones that I have questions about is that I just noticed last night that there's a, it looks like a chip in the foundation, and it's maybe a couple centimeters deep. And when I notice it, it looks like the water is coming up from underneath the underneath the foundation, because it was quite watery. And then the other one is that there's a puddle of water underneath where the chimney comes down.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, this is a poured concrete foundation, Laura?
Yes, I believe it's
yes.
Poured
okay.
concrete.
Good.
Yes.
All right. So
it was built 58 years ago, and it's in Monona.
Okay. And this sounds like you've got what's called hydrostatic head pressure. Basically, the soil around your house is saturated. And it's rained a lot here the last month. I mean, this is one of the wettest. You know, I'm a farmer. my pastures are in great shape because we've had a lot of rain in June and July. So what we may have going on there is that the soil, there's a lot of moisture in the soil under your house. And, of course, there's a joint between the wall, footing, and floor because you're, you know, those were not completely sealed. They weren't all cast as one piece. And then concrete shrinks, so there's a little joint. So if you've got some water coming up from under the floor, if it's coming up around where the columns are, coming up around where the chimney is, then you probably have significant moisture underneath that basement floor. And 58 years ago, we didn't put water barrier or vapor barriers or anything under the floor, so the water comes in pretty easily. You're going to have to decide how annoying this is. If it is really annoying, you can put you can retrofit a water collection system inside the basement, and most houses is $1,500 to $2,500. So they'll come in, they'll take a saw, they'll cut out a foot to 18 inches of concrete next to the wall. They'll put in drain tile, wash stone, silt sock, sump pump, and a pump. And so when water comes in, it will be intercepted and will simply be pumped outside. There are quite a few companies that do that. In, I believe you said you were in Monona, so yes, in the Madison area, you've got multiple choices of people. And some of them are franchises, and they've been fairly well-trained, and others are local contractors who've been at work for 50 years. So determine how much this annoys you. If it's just an unfinished basement, like my house, I get a little water now and then. I'm too cheap to spend $2,500. I'll just wait for it to dry up in a day or two and keep my dehumidifier running. So determine what your needs are, and, of course, you can always get a free estimate from some people and see whether you think it's worth the investment or not.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Laura, for calling. And, you know, is this whole business, are there new foundations? Are we seeing problems with the new foundations at all?
Yes. Unfortunately, we are. And generally, it's builder error. Mm. And I know I'm going to get calls on this, especially from the building inspector in Green Bay, who hates it when I say it. But we have municipalities in Wisconsin, townships, villages, that are not enforcing the Uniform Dwelling Code. And this is why, Larry, I'm suggesting to people that if they're buying a brand new house, do not rely upon the jurisdiction that has authority over the building permit. Actually hire a home inspector to come through this house for you. Because we've had two-year-old homes where we've had to do tens of thousands of dollars of work because the foundation walls were rotating and tilting inward because of the construction errors. So there is no reason with modern materials and modern engineering, Larry, modern waterproofing, I should be able to build you a foundation in the middle of Lake Monona that'll be structurally sound, will never leak, and floats. If I build it in the middle of Lake Monona, I can certainly build it on dry land. So there's no reason with what we have for current technology and products that we cannot build a house that is absolutely satisfactory and has a tremendously long life. But unfortunately, that is not always the case in Wisconsin. So it's really a case. We keep saying, Larry, one of our themes on this program always is buyer, educate yourself. Know what you're doing. Make sure if you don't know what you're doing, hire a professional who knows what they're doing so that they can protect your interests. Homes are the biggest investment most people are ever going to make. And we are seeing so much litigation coming across my desk right now that with people who are unhappy with their foundations, they're unhappy with leaks, they're unhappy with framing. And it's tragic to see this because a little bit of money and a little bit of expertise put in on the front end saves a lot of aggravation, a lot of money on the other end.
Wally in Fenimore has something for us next, John. Hi, Wally.
Everybody there. Sounding good on the air. Good information.
Thank you. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm kind of dealing with, I guess I'll call it a labor of love. I have an old tile building that my great-great-grandfather built back in the mid to late 1800s, and it needs tuck pointing. I mean, there's gaps in there and all of that. I guess my first question, is a tile building worth doing that with? And second, if it is, what kind of mortar would I want to use with it? I know it's going to take me forever to get it all tuck pointed. It's a slow process. I guess that's where my question really lies right now.
Okay.
Wally, I wish we had a picture of this. I would like to see this building. The clay tiles, the hollow clay tiles, a Des Moines Tile Company was a big manufacturer here in the Midwest, were an invention for fireproof construction. They were used a lot in large cities in lieu of wood. And they were used as backup walls for masonry. So you'd build the building structurally out of clay tile. I'm sure driving around Wisconsin, Larry, you've probably seen some clay tile silos.
Yeah.
So because they were so impermeable to moisture and because they were fireproof and so long-lived, we used a lot of clay tile. I've got a 1924 6-unit here in Madison that is constructed of them. Usually, a building like Wally's is going to have an exterior covering over it. Often, it was an application of stucco. Now, we do have silos where they didn't bother to stucco, so I'm assuming Wally's building something like that. The first thing I would do, Wally, is see if there is any historic value to this building. Now, it's going to depend upon when it was constructed. If it was 1850s, 1860s, and is an early example of tile building, you may be able to get support from the State Historical Society of Wisconsin for a tax credit. So you might get a tax credit equal to 25%. And all of our listeners who have old houses need to know this, or who live in historic districts. You can go to wisconsinhistory.org or just Google State Historic Society. When you get there, click on Home Historic Homeowner Tax Credit. Don't start a project until you've read to see whether the state is going to help you. The state gave away, I think, something like $235 million last year, Larry, in assistance to homeowners contractors, developers to try to preserve our historic building. So, Wally, if your building is historic, you probably get information from the city, from the Fenimore Historic Society. Obviously, you live in an old city. Now, generally, that is a hard-baked tile. It has a pretty good compressive strength, so usually you can use a Portland-type mortar if a Portland-type mortar is what is used, and you may have to have a local mason take a look at that mortar. If it's 1850s, it's going to be a lime putty mortar. If it's 1890s, it may be a Portland cement mortar. So this is one I'm not going to be able to diagnose over the air, but start out with a little bit of research. Find out what you really have there. Find out if it's really worth preserving. Answer that question for yourself. And then have a local mason take a look at the mortar and design the suitable mortar for you for tuck pointing.
There we go.
I really appreciate it. Like I said, it's kind of a labor of love. It's the only remaining building that he built. So, you know, it'd be kind of cool to be able to have it saved and
yeah.
Future generations of our family that is going to own the property can feel the same way.
Indeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So pretty cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Wally, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Stephen and Racine up next. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I've got an 8-inch concrete block foundation wall I'm straightening. The house is jacked up. The problem is on the inside of the house, they put on several layers of a white, what I call waterproofing in a can.
Right.
How do I get it off?
Oh, boy. Are you a young man? Oh, my. I do. Now, it may exist, Stephen, but I don't know of a material that will strip that. The problem with adding stripper to block is that we end up with some alkali reactions. I think you're probably going to have to do a little research. Take a look at companies like Citrus Strip that have a fairly innocuous base to their strippers. I'm sure what was happening is, as we said earlier, these CMU, these block walls, have a tendency to leak. And so they applied waterproofing. The problem is the waterproofing has to be applied to the exterior if we want it to work. Not the interior. So again, as we've recommended earlier, you know, take a look at your gutters, your drainage, your grading, and all of those things first. And then you'll probably just have to do a bit of studying. I will try to spend a little time before the next program to look into this a little bit. The problem with many latex bases is latex bases, when they get wet, can grow mold, whereas, of course, concrete doesn't. But
right.
What we may be applying to our walls is actually a mushroom-growing formula rather than a waterproofing. So, Steve, you do some research, and I'll do some research, and maybe next program you'll have an answer, I'll have an answer, or we'll both have an answer, and we'll agree.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate the call. John Freiberger, our guest today of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg. Lots of callers online. We'll go right back to the phones and David in New Richmond next. David, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, with the popularity, I see a lot of people putting metal roofs now on their houses, and I'm wondering, is there any special considerations, venting, that sort of thing? A friend put a metal roof on their cottage up north and ended up with moisture problems in their upstairs bedroom. So just wondering what the scoop is on metal roofs going from foundations up to the other side of the building.
Right. Well, metal roofs can really be great. You can get very long warranties on the finish nowadays. There's a lot of different companies that provide them. There's a lot of different qualities of metal roofs. There are the ones that are simple overlapped, which are basically not a whole lot better than an agricultural roof. There's the standing seam. There's at least 8 types of standing seam roofs. I really like the standing seam roofs with the hidden clips. The problem with the overlap roofs is we have fasteners. The fasteners have to be put in just so far so that the little gasket is not overly compressed, but yet is compressed just enough. So, the edges can be a problem with wind driving moisture underneath. We also have to be very careful that the substrate is correct, so that we've got the correct thickness of roof sheathing. In many cases, you have to have a thicker roof sheathing because of the fasteners. Then you have to make sure that you've got a weather barrier, a primary weather barrier, underneath the metal roofing. So as we keep saying, if you're going to buy a metal roof from Smith Metal Roofing, the first thing you want is you want all their technical documents, you want their warranties, and you want the installation instructions. If you do not install a metal roof correctly, you can get water under it, you can get water through a poorly applied felt or roof wrap, and you can end up with damage to the roof sheathing. So he's probably going to have to get a forensic person out there to take a look, locate what the problems are. It's possible that a blower door test would help with that, because if water's coming in, there's got to be a hole, help locate the hole. But there's metal roofs are a wonderful, long-lived, if expensive type of roofing, but they have to be put on in the correct manner. And pay for the quality. You know, don't just buy the least, you know, don't go out and buy the least expensive thing from the local big box and try putting it on yourself without ever looking at the installation instructions, because I do get called in on metal roof problems with some frequency.
Sure. And his question, my friend's question was, his old shingle roof had a vent on it, and when they put the metal roof on, there was no vent on there. So he was wondering about condensation, actually, was his question.
Yes. Most metal roofs will have some sort of venting. Again, what he's going to have to do is he's going to have to go to the website of the manufacturer and see what the installation instructions said. Is this an exposed fastener roof?
No.
It's a standing seam.
Yes.
Okay. And those, the nice thing about metal roofs is you can take them off and put them back on again. But if it was put on incorrectly by the contractor, and if it's within 5 years of the date of the signing of the contract, he probably has an implied warranty under Wisconsin contract law. Now, I'm not giving legal advice. Tell him to talk to a lawyer about that. But if it was, he should determine if it was put on correctly. If it wasn't put on correctly, he should talk to an attorney if this is something that was done in the last few years.
All right. Well, I appreciate your expertise and Larry's show for getting experts like you on.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, David. Really appreciate that call and your comments. Rod in Arlington has something else for us, so let's go there. Hi, Rod.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have my wife and I have a house that was part of our family's original homestead, and it was built over 100 years ago. It had Lannan stone walls in it, and when my grandfather tore it down to a frame in the late 50s, early 60s, and redid it, he put block windows in, and there were block windows on all four sides of the foundation. Since then, we've done some changes and some additions, and we've actually got only three of those windows still exposed on two walls, a south wall and a west wall. My question is, actually I have two. One is, would it be a good idea, and is there an available product that we could use if we wanted to take out a few of those block windows in order to give us better ventilation in the summertime? And second of all, he coated the Lannan stone walls that were in the basement. It was originally a dirt floor. He put concrete in and sewer lines, and then he appears to have had it sprayed with the same type of material that you would line a silo with, and that's starting to break loose and peel off and break away, and I'm wondering if that's something that can just take it off and have it redone, or does it necessarily have to have anything done with it?
I don't think it necessarily has to have anything done with it. It may have some fungal growth growing in it.
Okay.
I think I'd probably do is pull off what's loose and leave the rest. I don't think I'd put a lot of energy into it. As long as the basement smells okay, it doesn't have that musty sort of smell. Dehumidification running. It's always hard with stone walls because stone walls breathe moisture. But have a good energy efficient dehumidifier and keep that running. As far as the old block windows, it's really your choice. Some of these old farmhouses had some pretty nice basement windows because they really used the basements. Some of the old farmhouses had second kitchens in the basement for canning. They had the laundries in the basement, so they put some pretty good windows in. If you go below grade, you can put in a wood window if it's a good quality wood window, but there are also fiberglass windows, which my personal feeling is are superior to the vinyl windows, especially when you're in a damp location below grade. So I'm sure that you can find good quality windows that would work there. I would probably do it myself just because I do like the light and the ventilation, but it doesn't sound like something that you have to do. It's
right.
Really your choice.
Okay, well, we do have a little bit of a musty smell down in the basement. I do have a dehumidifier running. And we have, just in the last few years, had the house foundation foam air sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's made a huge difference in the wintertime. We can tell a temperature difference. I even did what I call the candle test as they cleaned the boxes out before they filled them with foam. I put candles up there just to see how much airflow there was, and in a couple of them it was pretty good, and after they got done, it's been sealed, you know, real good and tight, and we've noticed some of the musty smell has gone away also after they did that. So okay, I just wondered if maybe that would help with just general ventilation. I've thought about an air exchanging system.
Well,
but haven't gotten that far into it yet.
The air exchanging system really is the best. And again, I'm relying upon the archives of the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, Air Conditioning Engineers. It's nice to be able to open the windows in April, May, you know, late September, October.
Yeah.
We open the windows in July, and we've got this damp, nasty outside air that comes in the basement and cools and becomes even damper and nastier.
Yep,
so we have to be a little bit careful about what we do. If you are thinking about putting in whole house ventilation, it sounds like you're really tightening up this old farmhouse. You may want to take a look at heat recovery vent systems or energy recovery vent systems, and in your long-term planning, plan to integrate that into your mechanical system.
What kind of money are we looking at for a system like that or an air exchanging system?
Part of it depends on what your existing system is, but you're anywhere from probably $2,200 to $7,000, depending upon how intricate you get.
Okay.
Now, you have an older house that's always going to leak. On the brand-new houses now that have half an air change per hour, we are really having to design very, very carefully. Your house is going to be leaky enough, even with the good work you've done on the sill boxes, that you don't have to be quite as careful. So it is going to be a bit of a range. Do talk to an HVAC contractor who has done this before and knows something about old houses.
There okay, you. Great.
All right. Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Sandra in Mount Pleasant, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have an old stucco home, and the only thing underneath is a small crawl space large enough to get at the water pipes and things. There's another corner of the house that doesn't have crawl space, a room on the northeast corner that has sunk. Like I noticed in the bedroom, the wall cracked,
mm-hmm.
and then space between the bottom boarding and the floor, and then outside I noticed wasps going in, and I noticed there was a large crack between the fascia or whatever and
sure.
the stucco.
Mm-hmm.
So this corner like seems to have sunk. Would jacking it up be? We kind of tried to, we thought maybe water got under there.
Mm-hmm.
And we made a small correction and put a spout where a long spout to draw water away from there. So I don't know what.
Well, yeah. I expect that what we have is we've got a house with a crawl space, and then somebody poured a slab on grade. So it's probably is just a concrete slab there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that concrete slab doesn't have frost protection, and the soil can erode underneath, so it has settled over time. Mm-hmm. You may want to talk to a local engineer, architect, or a registered home inspector to have them take a look at it, do a little digging along the side. We do have ways now of raising concrete so it stays raised rather than putting mud underneath, which would tend to dry out and leave. We're actually using structural foam. So we're having a little bit better success right now. But take a look at this thing as a system. Is that floor cold? Are we getting condensation in that area? Are we going to be better out actually removing that concrete slab and putting something else in there that is easier to heat, easier to control? So give a little bit of thought. Get somebody in there who can can draw a little diagram for you. Think about how that room performs as part of your house, and then come up with a plan to either repair or possibly even replace. The roof and walls can always be held in place while the floor is removed, and you could add to the crawl space with a with a shallow frost wall or something, so that this room works better than it currently does.
Yeah, the crawl space doesn't go that far to that room, but yeah.
Okay, so it sounds like you really need somebody to help you figure out how your house is put together.
Yeah.
All right?
You're right. Thanks.
So study before, study, plan before we do anything.
Thanks, Andra. Alan Kakana, what's on your mind?
Okay, thanks, Barry. I have a three-part question for John. Number one, I have a brick house built in 1940. And the brick is falling all around the foundation and around some of the windows. I need to know what causes that, number one. Number two, what is the solution to fix that? And number three, does he have any recommendations for a company or companies in that general area that might would do the repairs?
Okay. I think, Larry, we're going to have to go to that one after the break.
We got about 30 seconds or so. You can start on it.
Well, the part three, I think what you're going to have to do, we're going to discuss the first two parts after the news break, and that you just need to interview your contractors carefully and find somebody who has done restoration work. Because average guy who lays up block walls or new brick walls can't do this. You're going to need to really interview.
So hang on, and we'll get back and answer the other two parts of your question right after this look at the news. Our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with John. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at home improvement issues with John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you along. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And as we broke for news, John, we had Al on from Kakana with a 1940s brick home. The brick is spalling and wondering about what causes spalling and also what you can do about it. What's the solution?
Right. Well, what Al shared with us is it sounds like it's spalling down near the ground. It's spalling around the windows. And those, to me, indicate we've got moisture issues. Usually when a brick spalls, it's because moisture has gotten into the brick. And there's two types of spalling. Frost spalling is the most typical one. But there actually are some chemical reactions where you'll get crystalline changes within the brick that produce pressure. I really don't understand it, frankly. but I've seen it. But one way or the other, this sounds like it is moisture-related. Yeah, I don't know what type of bricks Al has. Bricks really change in the 1940s. We go from old wood-fired and coal-fired kilns to high-temperature gas kilns. The bricks get much, much harder. Our mortars change. We do occasionally see bricks that are spalling simply because they did not put in expansion joints, because in the 1940s they didn't understand that these bricks and the mortar were still going to move. Now, the old soft bricks and soft mortar moves, but they're so soft that things happen internally. When you get to these hard bricks and hard mortars, things just break. So I think that what Al is going to have to do is first, he's going to have to talk to a historic brick expert. I don't know anyone in that area. Again, we can call some home inspectors. We may have some home inspectors that have extra education on masonry. We can also look under restoration masons or restoration in the phone book in the Kakana area. We're going to have to get a knowledgeable professional in there to give a little bit of advice. The big problem with this, of course, is if we cut out bad bricks, where do we get the matching bricks?
Yeah.
There is a website called USA Brick. Mr. John Gavin's got something like 4 or 5 million bricks down in Illinois. You can send John a brick and he'll try to match it. He's done that for me a few times. But you're going to have to start working on resources, Al, and understand and plan before you hire somebody to actually do the work.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck, Al. Thanks again for your question. Ray in Stevens Point has something for us. Ray, hello.
Hi, I am buying a home that was built in 1930. It has a stone foundation. It has some water issues in the basement periodically, and I'm trying to resolve those. Foundation walls on the outside go up about 2 to 2.5 feet from the ground to where the shingles begin. It has windows in the basement that are at ground level. So one thought I had was to put in window wells by the basement windows and bring in dirt to create a grade away from the house. I need to know how to treat the foundation walls on the outside of the house. Again, they're stone, and they've been covered with some kind of a plaster or concrete material. I don't know.
Okay.
So it sounds like you've got a dash-applied stucco. Dash-applied means that they basically mixed up a Portland cement stucco plaster. It was sort of sloppy. They stuck a beaver bristle brush in it, and they flipped the brush at the wall. They actually dashed it against the wall, so it has sort of a pebbly, uneven look to it.
Sort of, yeah.
Right.
And some of it is peeling off, and there's some cracks and stuff. So I'm figuring whatever I apply, I need to fill in the cracks and everything.
Right. You can actually go back to that sort of dash thing. Of course, this is discolored over the years, so you might have to apply some sort of wash over the top of it. I don't know of a good restoration resource. There are things on National Park Service about restoration of stucco, but I know that those publications don't deal real well with what you have up there. I'm actually working on writing one right now. I guess when I get that done, we'll have something available. But basically, you can restore it. The other thing you can do, this is what many people have done, is they've removed what's loose and they just let it fall off over time. And then they just restore the stone, and sometimes that old stone actually looks better than the stucco. Your idea of adding some soil and window well sounds like a good one. You do want to maintain as much room as you can between the shingle siding, the wood siding, and grade, because that stone wall has moisture moving up through it, and right now it's got 2.5 feet on the exterior to dry to as well as the interior. So don't get the soil up too high. As we said earlier, half inch per foot pitch for 10 feet is great. I wouldn't go any higher than you really need to. Does that cover it pretty well, Ray?
Yep, I think it does.
Okay, good.
there we go. Betty in Green Bay up next. Hi, Betty.
Hello. I'm calling about a radon mitigation system. I have a home that I've been in for 12 years, and the previous owners had a radon mitigation system put in. I really didn't get a lot of information about it when I bought the house, unfortunately. And what I'm just kind of wondering is, how should they be maintained? You know, it seems like when you look at it, it's a pipe that's down in the basement. It has a red monitor to it, and it always looks the same to me. Then there's a pipe that goes outside, you know, through my garage, and it looks a little bit like it's a little soiled. But I haven't done anything in 12 years. So what can you advise me about radon mitigation systems?
Okay, that little U-shaped thing in the basement is telling you that there's a pressure differential between the inside and the outside of the pipe. So the little, usually it's red liquid in there, so you can read it easily. And as long as it's not level, that means the fan is working. So someplace you've got a low motion, you know, maybe 50 CFM fan that is depressurizing underneath your basement floor. So if that little indicator in the basement, if the levels are exactly the same, then your system is not working, and you need to call somebody, you know, out of the phone book who does radon systems, and almost anybody could replace the fan if that needs to be replaced.
Okay.
The other thing you may want to do is to do a 6-month alpha tracker test kit to see if it's actually working. Now, the fan may be working, but is it actually cleaning out the radon? Do your test from midwinter to midsummer, or midsummer to midwinter, so you get the air conditioning system, the heating season, and everything is turned off, because radon levels go up and down in your basement by a factor of 4 or 8, depending upon what's going on. Is the furnace on? Is the door open? Is the wind blowing, etc.? So make sure you're safe with the existing system. You look at that indicator every now and then to see if the fan is working, and that should take care of you.
And as long as the red levels are uneven, it should be okay.
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Ron in Ironwood, thank you for calling.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I have a house, 1940s, I believe. It's got the concrete block
basement, and I have sort of a bedroom and bathroom down there, but they're not really finished out. My issue in spending money and time to finish it out is legal regress, so it actually counts as an additional bedroom and bathroom. And my house, let's say it's about rectangle, maybe 65 by 30, the main rectangle, and then attached to that is an additional square that's about 10 by 10, and that has a separate basement. And that basement opens up with a staircase into the garage. So what I'm wondering is if I can just cut the block and make a doorway between those two basements, and then I'll have regress up that stair into the garage. And what are the structural issues that I need to worry about?
Well,
you're into my basement wall.
Yeah, I would like an engineer to take a look at this. Most likely, you're not going to have a significant structural issue other than needing a header. The concern with the wall is what is the soil pressure on the wall, and if we cut this wall, are we going to end up with some movement? Do we need to add like a flexural member or some reinforcement? And this, we really need to have a structural engineer or an architect take a look at it. But yes, that will give you, as long as I think it's 75, the stairways within 75 feet of the bedroom, you're okay. The other thing to remember from the Uniform Dwelling Code is that your windows for the bedroom have to equal, I believe it's 8% of the floor space, 50% of which opens. So you may want to take, and again, you can go online and just type in Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code, read Chapter 21 on egress and light, and make sure that whatever you do is going to meet code. Remember to take out a permit and have it inspected, so if you ever do sell the house, there's a paper record that we know it was approved.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. I can our home, when we were remodeling, had to put a bedroom in on the third floor. We had to add a light in the roof in order to get the extra amount of outside light.
That's right. We don't want dull black bedrooms in Wisconsin where the winters are so long.
Oh, man. Nancy in Three Lakes, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a question about a cottage that is used as a seasonal home only. When it was built, it was built as a year-round home. It was built in the late 1980s with a walkout basement. So we turn the heat off in the winter as we use it seasonally. And when it was built, the basement is all concrete block. It was coated with black tar type of material for waterproofing on the outside, and then covered with 3-inch white insulation on the outside around everything that was below ground. Interior, half of the basement was finished with drywall with bad insulation and plastic sheeting up against the concrete walls. And on the other half, it's exposed concrete block. And the half of the basement that's finished with drywall has a glazed ceramic tile on it. And when we turn off the heat in the wintertime and leave it, and return in, say, April or May and turn the heat on, we consistently have a lot of water buildup on the concrete on the floor and on some of the wall areas. And I was wondering whether we would benefit from having a different type of insulation put on the outside of the walkout basement.
The answer to that is no. The insulation is not going to control the water vapor levels inside the house. Now, turning the heat off in the winter is really a good way of growing mold, unless you've got a house really, really, really well dehumidified before you turn off the heat. Remember that mold will grow absent liquid water at 70% relative humidity. Now, I think what's happening there is your tile floor and things are cold, so they become the first condensing surface. So you turn on the heat, you are distributing water vapor around the house, and it is condensing out on the things that are colder. But I think I'd like you to really think about if there's a way of maintaining the humidity and some heat in this house during the winters. I don't want you to come back sometime and find everything is white. I had that happen in Madison with a couple that went to Florida and turned their townhouse down to 50 degrees. When we came back, There's aspergillus and penicillin on every square foot of the basement. They save $300 on heating bill, and they spent $25,000 on mold remediation. So this was meant to be a full-time house. I think you need to do a little bit of research and think a little bit about shutting things down in the winter.
Yeah, yeah. Something to think about for sure, Nancy. Thank you for calling. Sue in Waukesha emailed to say that she was told if a house is inspected, you're required to share the information with prospective buyers. She isn't planning on selling in the near future, just wants to see how the roof, windows, and so forth are doing. Would she have to share that down the road?
We're sort of in a legal question here, but I think the answer is not necessarily. My understanding, I am a member of the Wisconsin Realtors Association, and I read the legal brief, so this is non-official. But basically, if you sold the house, you have to disclose what you know is wrong. If you have somebody comes in and says your roof has 2 years left and you replace the roof, well, you don't have to tell them that 3 years ago somebody said your roof was bad and you've replaced the roof. You just say it has a new roof. So I think go ahead and use the home inspector as an asset for information on your house to help you plan out maintenance and maybe energy efficiency improvements. But when you sell the house, my understanding of the law is deficiencies. Now, you're going to hire a broker. That broker has a higher responsibility than you do to basically to talk to you and to make sure that all deficits are reported. So I would not worry about the home inspection at all, and I would rely upon your licensed real estate broker if you ever do sell the house.
Ron in Ironwood, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Love the show.
Thank you.
I had a quick question. Hopefully it's quick. I bought a house on foreclosure. It was built in 1960. When we started tearing into, doing a little remod, realized there was no insulation in the walls. So we ended up it was a little Cape Cod style house, one level. We ended up just taking it right to the studs, took out all the old insulation that was in the ceiling. I have R38 in the attic right now, and I'm going to put R21 in the 2x6 ceiling joists. And R15 in the walls is 2x4 walls. My question is, should I go with craft face or should I go with unfaced and just do the clear poly? I've heard conflicting reports about the craft face is basically useless for a vapor barrier. And also, it's built in 1960, but whoever were the contractors, they were a little bit uneven on their measurements. So a lot of the wall cavities are like anywhere from 14 inches to 11 inches back and forth, depending if it's next to a window or wherever. And so I'm going to have to be ripping a lot of the bats and, to fit the cavity. So I don't know if it was going to be easier just to go with the unfaced.
I think that going with the unfaced friction fit is where you're going to want to go. It's going to be a whole lot easier. Certainly, with cutting things, your craft face is simply not going to provide an adequate vapor barrier, and you're going to need to go to the visqueen or plastic sheeting to do it. If there's any areas you haven't torn down, such as maybe upstairs ceilings or something, you can actually paint those with a certified vapor barrier type of paint. But it sounds like you're headed in the right direction. One thing to think about is to blower door test this house before you close everything up. Let's see how leaky this house is.
Okay.
If the house really leaks badly, you may want to think about doing 2 inches of spray urethane in the cavities and then 3 or 4 inches of fiberglass insulation. But let's put a little science in back of this first. Go to Focus on Energy, find an energy analyst. Depressurize to 50 pascals, see how many air changes you have. Now, you're going through a lot of work here. And if air blows right through the insulation and out the holes where the outlets and things are around the vapor barrier, we're not really achieving all you can easily achieve.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks for calling. Susie and Toma, your turn. Hi, Susie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been waiting and waiting for this gentleman to come on. Here's the scoop. My husband and I have a house that's about 7 years old, and one of our bedroom doors squeaked. So he sprayed something on it. So now my problem is that either I have to have the door completely open or closed, and it won't stay open halfway without a doorstop next to it. Is there something I can do to that door so I can get it to stay open halfway without a doorstop?
Oh, dear. That's I suppose changing husbands isn't an option.
I was thinking about rubbing some dirt on the hinges, but I don't think that would work either. But it's just driving me crazy.
Something is not plumb. So your door was not installed perfectly
okay.
straight. So there is probably a hinge out there that has enough friction in it.
Mm-hmm.
So Google some hardware catalogs.
Okay.
There must be a hinge that provides a little bit of friction so that you could keep a door half open if you wanted. I mean, everything in the world's been invented as far as hardware.
we just have to find the
right thing.
My husband's such a perfectionist. You know, we can't have that squeak. Well, now my, it's either open or closed.
The other thing he could try doing is take the hinges and use some silicone spray, which is a lubricant, but it's not an oil spray. See if we can drive the oil spray out. And the silicone lubricant may get rid of the squeak, but not reduce the friction so much that this somewhat crooked door closes. So give that a try. And otherwise, you're just going to have to go online and find something that works or use that little wedge door stopper.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right.
All right.
Sorry.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Lori in Rice Lake, you have a quick question for us.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. We do have a airtight sprayed home. And my question to you is, we have a air exchanger, and I'm confused exactly how to use it for the summertime and the wintertime. Could you please run that back to us and explain to us how that works?
Okay, it's going to depend a little bit upon the type of HRV you have and whether some of them include dehumidification. Now, some of them don't. There are dehumidification add-ons that are on the market now that you can use during the summer. So first, you're going to have to do a little research. So you've got the brand, the model number is probably on it. Go to the manufacturer, download the installation operation instructions, and then if that's not clear, call their tech support. Most of these companies are very, very good about providing information to you. And if you are in a situation where the humidity is hard to control. Now, you're in northern Wisconsin, so you don't have the issues we have down here. And I always hate to... You know, Wisconsin is so various. What works one area, what is needed in one area is not needed in the other. So start with the manufacturer. Talk to your HVAC contractor, if that's the person who put it in for you, and get their recommendations. But there's a lot of new things on the market for controlling humidification as far as whole house ventilation that weren't there 7 years ago.
There we go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Can you use reclaimed brick from an old farmhouse to make a patio? He had tried it. Chris tried it a few years ago with a different brick, and it didn't work.
Yeah. We were saying earlier, with the gentleman with the Spalding brick, his brick have really changed over the years. Some really fall apart in moisture, and others really don't. So it really does depend upon the brick and how well-drained it is. If you have a compacted base of line fines or something like that underneath, you can use reclaimed brick, but it's never going to last as long as modern concrete pavers. But saying that, I've got a nice reclaimed brick sidewalk that comes up to my old farmhouse, and every year I've got about 10 bricks I got to sort of take out with a chisel and pop a couple new bricks in. But it's a good thing to recycle them and make use.
John, always a pleasure. You'll be back on October 13th, and we'll do this all over again. Thank you so much.
Been wonderful being here. I look forward to October 13th.
John Freiberger of Freiberger Construction Consulting of Fitchburg, our guest. He'll be back October 13th. Thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.